This time on your weekly Constitutional.
Our Declaration of Independence declares rights that they exist and they don't come from government. And that's the same thing, you know, the Constitution's based on that premise. But then the Constitution sets up a form of government that includes a court system whose unique purpose is to protect rights.
That was Linda Monk, the author of a book called The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide. It's an updated version of a book she wrote 25 years ago. But hey, a lot's happened in constitutional law in the last 25 years. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional. And this week, it's about the Bill of Rights.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Wouldn't it be a great idea if somebody wrote a user's guide for the United States Constitution, or at least for the Bill of Rights? Well, someone has. Her name is Linda Monk, and I'm going to let her tell you all about it.
My name's Linda Monk. I'm a constitutional scholar and graduate of Harvard Law School. I'm also a journalist, and I've written two nationally award-winning books, received the American Bar Association Silver Gavel Award twice, and one of those winners of the Silver Gavel Award is my new book, The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide.
Now, that's a revised edition of an earlier one, right?
Indeed it is. Yeah. The book's 25 years old. It won a special Silver Gavel Award for the bicentennial of the Bill of Rights, and that's 25 years later, and it reflects 25 years of my scholarship and personal experience with the Bill of Rights.
Well, I will say to everyone who is listening to our conversation now that it's extremely well written. It's written for a general audience. There's not a lot of jargon in it, and what little is unavoidable, you explain beautifully. You start very much as I like to start whenever I'm talking about the Bill of Rights, with the very basic question of what is a right. So why don't we start there?
It's a fundamental question, and Americans misuse that term a lot. I start my book with a cartoon from Calvin and Hobbes. Calvin, as you know, asked fundamental questions in life, and he's doing his math homework, and Dad's concerned. Dad says, "You've written here 2 + 2 = 5. That's not right. You can't do that." And Calvin says, "Yes, I can. I've got my rights." And as I say in the book, well, Calvin doesn't really have the right to get math wrong, and certainly his math teacher isn't going to acknowledge that right. So when we talk about rights, they aren't just things in the ether or in the abstract. It has a lot to do with how those rights are recognized within the community and by law. That's not all they are, but we look to right if the Black's Law Dictionary would say a right is something that we have a legal claim to or a tradition. But then there's also this idea of natural rights, which we think of as the most fundamental human rights. And those really don't come from government. They don't come from social recognition. They're supposed to be intrinsic to who we are as being human. And the classic example of a natural right we express in the Declaration of Independence, our American credo, where it says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed." That's one sentence that says the very purpose of our government is to protect rights, and that there are these certain unalienable, or we would say natural rights, that precede government and give government its reason for being.
Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, the consent of the governed, all extremely important things. And the only bit of jargon that's in that phrase that I think people probably have wondered about from time to time is that word unalienable. Mm. That actually comes from property law, and it simply means you can't give it away. You can't sell it. It cannot be separated from you. And I think that that is something that's, again, that it goes to the very nature of being a human being. Now, of course, if you want to talk about the origin, religious people will think that these rites emanate from God or whichever God they happen to worship. But the origin is less important, I think, than what it actually does. And you make a very good distinction between something that's a natural right, something you're born with that you can't alienate, and something that's actually protected in the law.
That's the second point I want to make. It goes to a right and how it's protected. And you learned, as I did in law school, Stuart, there's no right without a remedy. That practical aspect of, if you can't enforce your rights against someone else, does it really exist? Now, we would say yes, as a human right, it exists. But the American proposition, as expressed in our Constitution, is to set up a court system whose unique function is to create remedies for rights. That's where we go and we contest our rights. We ask the court to either devise or support and enforce a remedy for those rights. And that's really how our Constitution is different than our Declaration of Independence. Our Declaration of Independence declares rights that they exist and they don't come from government. And that's the same thing, you know, the Constitution's based on that premise, but then the Constitution sets up a form of government that includes a court system whose unique purpose is to protect rights.
Yep, the whole concept of judicial review, which we've talked about on this show many times, and how extremely important it is to have a strong and independent judiciary that's going to be able to enforce these rights. I had to smile a little bit when you gave the example that, you know, you can't enforce your right to pursue happiness, which comes out of the Declaration, which is not law, because there's actually a case in my constitutional law book for my general introductory class from 1937 that I always chuckle about. We're actually studying the power of the national government to tax, which is extremely broad, as you know. And in 1937, the Supreme Court decided a case, and for all you wonks, I will say that's the Charles C. Stewart Machine Company versus Davis case.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, the employer was objecting to the new Social Security tax, and he said that it interfered with his pursuit of happiness.
They bought that of his employees.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's, you know, I was thinking to myself, man, I don't think I can think of a tax that doesn't interfere with my happiness. So there's really, and there's no way around it. But he failed.
One more case that I mentioned about Jacobson versus Massachusetts, which you're aware of, in terms of one person said that a mandatory vaccination law interfered with his blessings of liberty. Now, that was from the preamble to the Constitution. But again, the general idea of, there are certain parts of our Constitution, except the preamble, and certainly not the Declaration of Independence, that we have these legal remedies for.
And when we get right down to the nub of it, you know, what is a constitutional right? There are many different definitions of them, and you go over them in your book. The one that I've always focused upon, at least as an initial matter, is the idea that, by and large, our Constitution sets up a majoritarian system. That is, we vote on most important things. We vote on who our president is. We vote in our members of Congress. They turn around and vote on legislation. Everybody votes. City councils vote. And by and large, under our system, the majority wins. But a constitutional right puts something beyond majority rule, and it says it doesn't matter if every person in the United States votes for this, an individual can stop them if it is a recognized constitutional right. So the entire country could vote. Perhaps they're doing it right as we speak. Harris, shut up. You can't talk anymore. But that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if every person in the United States votes that way, because the government cannot take away my freedom of speech. That's a constitutional right.
Right. And that's part of why I keep reminding people we're a constitutional democracy, mm-hmm. which means we don't have strict majority rule. The Constitution sets up those areas where we, the people, because we're the ones that approved the Constitution in the first place, we've agreed to limit ourselves. Madison said, you know, it's where the greatest amount of power is in a government, that's where the greatest amount of tyranny comes. And in our government, we put the power in the majority, so that's where we mainly have to be careful.
You have to be very, very careful about that, because, you know, you can, again, a thought experiment, if you've got 50 students in a room, you know, 26 of those students can vote to do terrible things to the remaining 24. take away all their property, make them do all the work, if that's your country. And if it's a strict majority rule, you just have to have that, 50% plus one, and you can do terrible things to people who are not part of your group. That's what our Constitution is designed to prevent, the tyranny of the majority, at least in certain limited areas, such as the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, or especially the first eight.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Linda Monk, who has written an update to a book she wrote 25 years ago called The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide. Stick around. You're listening to Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue our discussion with Linda Monk, the author of The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide.
We've discussed the origin of the Bill of Rights on this show many times, but it's still worth mentioning. How did the Bill of Rights come about?
The Bill of Rights came about because in 1787, at the Constitutional Convention, when George Mason, the esteemed Virginian, moved to add a Bill of Rights to the Constitution, his motion was defeated. And unanimously, because the delegations voted by states, and he was even defeated in Virginia, which is astonishing. As he said, we can come up with a Bill of Rights in a day or two. Well, how did he know that? Because he was the author of the Virginia Declaration of Rights, and he'd already done it. Mm-hmm. So it's that puzzle to historians and certainly contemporary Americans. Why didn't the framers make that motion? Why didn't they go ahead and add a Bill of Rights when they could have? And there's a debate about that. Some people say, well, it's a long, hot summer in Philadelphia with no deodorant, no air conditioning. They kept the windows shut and there was an invasion of black flies. Maybe they were sick of each other after 4 months.
I know they were sick of each other.
I know that's probably the consensus of historians. I tend to disagree a bit because I'm thinking, wait a minute, the Bill of Rights. The reality was, and the argument becomes teased out in the Federalist Papers. Alexander Hamilton, whom I'm not as big a fan of, I love Lin-Manuel Miranda, but Alexander Hamilton himself, I wasn't so keen on. And he says, well, we don't need one because this is a government of people, not of sovereigns. And so we don't need to restrict ourselves. And by the way, the state constitutions all have Bill of Rights, so it's not really necessary. And I think the most critical argument opposed to that was actually one that George Mason raised in the convention, because people said, well, we don't really need them because of the state rights. And George Mason said there is this supremacy clause that puts the Constitution of the United States above the state constitutions. When they chose to go ahead and ratify the Constitution without a prior Bill of Rights, which was what was being considered, made suggestions for possible amendments. And then once the Constitution was ratified and the new Congress began, James Madison had run in Virginia on the platform of that he would support a Bill of Rights, even though he was an acknowledged Federalist. He had said that a Bill of Rights could be nothing more than a parchment barrier. And he had been amongst those who argued that a Bill of Rights wasn't really necessary. And yet when he ran for Congress from Virginia, he made the promise to the voters of Virginia that he would in fact introduce a Bill of Rights, which is what he did. So when Madison got to Congress in New York, he introduced on June 8th a series of proposed amendments. It was about 22 of them. And he had intended those amendments to be kind of inserted at various places in the Constitution. Most of them would be in Article 1, because that's where the powers of Congress are listed. And he and the persons in the Congress at the time saw the Bill of Rights as a limitation mainly on the Congress, because it had the power to act. He did include in there a provision where regarding freedom of speech and freedom of conscience, that no state would be allowed to restrict these freedoms in it also. But then the Senate got rid of that, and Madison said, well, gosh, that was the most important amendment in the whole list. So going back and forth with the House and the Senate, they finally narrowed it down to 12 proposed amendments That would be tacked on at the end. One of Madison's famous Federalist allies decided to make that motion, and he remarked at one point that Madison had become the patron saint of amendments and, in fact, maybe had too much pride of authorship in the Constitution itself, and that's why he didn't really want the amendments tacked on at the end.
So it goes through this convoluted process. It's ultimately ratified December 15th, 1791. And so now we've got a Bill of Rights. We tend to talk about the first 10 of them, and we talk about them as a Bill of Rights. And yet the last two, the 9th and the 10th Amendment, really had more to do with, well, the 9th, of course, the open-ended nature of rights, and we can talk about that in a minute. But the 10th is really more of a division of power between the states and the national government. So tell us about them. Tell us about those individual rights and how they have developed over the time. Your book is full of compelling stories.
Thank you. The interesting thing about the Bill of Rights as we think of it today is, of course, there were 12 proposed amendments. So what we think of as the First Amendment that protects freedom of religion, speech, press, assembly, petition, would have been the Third Amendment in the original, or it doesn't quite have the same sound to it, does it? It just really doesn't. So there's that to think of, that let's reorder them to start with. And then just looking, before we get into the stories, just looking at them generally, the First Amendment are the rights that most people think the most of, as I listed just previously. Second Amendment, the big contention about, is the Second Amendment a right to bear arms really a right of the people, therefore individual, or a right of militia? We can go into that later or not. And then the bulk of the rights in the Bill of Rights have to do, as you know as a law professor, with criminal procedure and punishment for crime. And what I have to point out to people often is, people speak of those as, well, it's just a technicality. Well, it's just a technicality. It's like, no, it's really close to half the Bill of Rights are about technicalities of what happens when people are searched or seized or accused of crimes or want a lawyer, et cetera.
Yeah, I think the word technicality is inappropriately used when it comes to individual constitutional rights. It can seem that way. Most people, there's a murder, they want to know who committed the murder, right? And if they think they've got the murderer gets punished, and that's what you're most interested in when you're watching a TV cop show. And so I think in that context, you know, all the legal stuff people tend to find boring or an irritating obstacle that the police or the prosecutors have to get past, and, you know, something that's, you know, being thrown up in the face of the good guys by a, you know, a nefarious defense lawyer. And yet, I've always thought,
mentality until you need it, right?
Precisely. I mean, I've always thought, I mean, I've never taken a job as a defender, but I've always deeply admired them. It's a very difficult thing to defend people, especially when you know they're guilty. But they're doing it because they're defending those rights for all of us. And so those are extremely important rights. And as you point out, they're almost half of the Bill of Rights is about protecting us, due process within the criminal context and other rights.
Yeah.
All right, please go on.
I'm wondering, building on that, if we want to jump right in with criminal procedure and rights and talk about Clarence Earl Gideon.
Gideon versus Wainwright, one of my favorite cases. Please tell us about it.
It means a lot to me because Clarence Earl Gideon is another one of those uneducated Americans, ordinary Americans, who you don't think of as being able to bring a Supreme Court case, and certainly not he. He was behind bars, had been convicted of a third felony at that point, breaking into a pool hall, stealing change from a jukebox. And he was an uneducated drifter. He had been in and out of jail numerous times, and he was convicted without a lawyer. And he said at the trial at the time, the Supreme Court says I have a right to a lawyer. Well, he was wrong. The Supreme Court had said in federal cases that the Bill of Rights protected a person having the right to have a lawyer. The government paid for you. And originally, the right to counsel just meant you had a right to pay for your own lawyer to be there, because in English courts, many times you didn't have the right to have your own paid lawyer. And the Supreme Court ruled through a number of cases that, at least in murder cases, going back to the Scottsboro Nine, that you should have, the state should have to be forced to pay for your lawyer. Remember, now there's two systems of justice going on, because the Bill of Rights applies to the federal government at this point, so you have a right to a lawyer in federal cases, but not in state cases. But most criminal cases are state cases. So here's Clarence Earl Gideon sitting in jail in Florida, accused of a crime, convicted of a crime, no lawyer, and he writes his own handwritten petition to the Supreme Court. In form of pauperis, meaning he has no money, and it's the case is selected to be heard, and he's appointed a very famous lawyer who goes on to be on the Supreme Court, Abe Fortas, and he writes this amazing letter to Abe Fortas, 28 handwritten pages, where he tells a story that'll break your heart. He tells about, he says, I've always been an individualist, a person who will not conform. And he talks about getting in arguments with his mother because she'd remarried, had a cruel stepfather. He gets sent to a reformatory and he says, of all the prisons I've ever been in, that is the worst. I still have scars on my body from the whippings I received there. And at the end, he says, I believe that each generation makes its own contribution to the to law and justice, and maybe this will be one of those small steps.
Wow. That's not the typical letter you get from somebody writing you from prison wanting representation.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's a contemporary, it's not in my book because it's just been recently revealed that it may be that Gideon had a cellmate who was a judge convicted of corruption, and maybe the judge actually helped him with this petition. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court was ready to review its decisions about when a person who had been accused of a felony, you know, more than a year or more in prison, had the right to a lawyer. And they accepted the case and eventually ruled that, yes, the Sixth Amendment applied to the states and required, in cases of a felony, that a defendant have the right to counsel.
Paid counsel. If he's indigent, paid the state
counsel.
Has to pay for
exactly.
him.
Exactly. Paid for by the state counsel. That's the crucial. Thank you, Professor.
No, that's perfectly good. I mean, that's the point that is often missed.
Yeah.
And that's really essential. Fast forwarding to 2018, I was just having a conversation with a colleague about this. We still don't really fully fund that constitutional commitment, do we?
Oh, beyond not fully fund. I mean, not even close. I mean, yeah. Walter Mondale, the former vice president, has written about that. There's a great movie, and I highly recommend it to your audience, called Gideon's Army. And it was filmed by HBO, and there's a photo of the very young, dynamic, energetic attorneys that are today's Gideon's Army, meaning they're assigned to represent people who don't have the money to pay for their own lawyer, and they're grossly overworked and underpaid, and in fact, so much so that some of these programs are suing the local the state government, saying, if you're not going to fund us any more than this, we're going to stop taking cases.
Wow.
Because it's such a gross violation of due process.
Yeah, I mean, I know that courts are notoriously reluctant to effectively raise taxes, to, you know, to issue an order that will mean, you know, significant increase in the tax burden, because, you know, they respect the democratic process and they want to have the elected officials who are responsible to the voters decide such matters. And yet, when you've got a case like Gideon that says that you've got to provide this counsel and then you don't fund it properly, well, then you really are undercutting that case egregiously. I mean, the level of justice that people are getting is just horrible.
This is me speaking as a nonpartisan scholar. It's no justice. And we have to be honest about that, and I'm not alone in calling that to people's attention. So I hope people will read the book to get more of a sense of how these constitutional rights do play out. And it's one of the most common rights we think of. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to a lawyer. If you cannot afford one, an attorney will be appointed for you.
Right. Those are meaningless words unless we fund it. I have an idea that I'm sure others have suggested. But what about a court not specifically mandating a certain level of funding? But what about the Supreme Court of the United States saying, whatever you spend on the prosecution, you must also spend on the defense?
Bingo. That's my, and this is starting to happen in places like Philadelphia, is that civil liberties advocates are starting to say, wait a minute, we need to get our people elected to be prosecutors, because they have all the resources, they make all the decisions. And if you want to make a real impact in how justice is carried out, have an impact on whose cases get brought to trial and even prosecuted to the first place. And the whole idea is, you know, plea bargaining of, you know, more than 97% of the cases are decided with a plea bargain. Do you even have a right to a jury then under that kind of system?
I'll tell you a story from my own law school experience. This is 30-some years ago. And I was in a class on criminal procedure, and the final examination went back to something the professor had been emphasizing all throughout the semester, and that is that given the limited funding of criminal defense lawyers, given the limited funding given to the judiciary generally, you know, which of the various devices that people are coming up with to work around that, you know, which do you think are good and which do you think are going to be ineffective? And I said, look, if ever there was a problem whose solution is singular and that can be solved just with more money, it's this. And I wrote a whole essay just about how it was unconstitutional, even immoral, not to fully fund our judiciary and specifically our criminal judiciary. I think I got 0 points.
I can believe that.
He really wanted me to talk about the things he talked about in class, but I felt so passionately about that I just decided to take a gamble, and it didn't pay off.
And yet we have a system of mass incarceration. So there's like multiple levels at which this problem plays out in terms of what we say are our constitutional rights versus what the actual impact are. And I think most contemporary Americans would agree, yeah, if you don't have a lawyer in the criminal justice system, it really doesn't matter if you're guilty or innocent. And that's exactly what the court said in the Gideon case in the 1960s.
These are unpopular rights to some extent because we see them as rewarding bad guys. We don't like criminals. I don't like criminals either, but I mean, that's what we do it. Just think about this, though. Think about you getting arrested. Think about you getting arrested for something you didn't do. That's the first thing you're going to have to do is find a lawyer. And I tell you, the retainers that a good lawyer is going to ask you for, six figures. And that's just the retainer. That's just the preliminary stuff. If you're going to go all the way through with a good team of lawyers, a trial, we're talking millions of dollars.
Right. And that's why the common refrain is, as you know, the best justice money can buy.
Yep.
So the Gideon case in particular calls us to account for what was a norm that was established in the 1960s versus what the reality is today. And the other piece of the reality is we can't afford all the prisons that it takes to put all these people in jail. So once we will acknowledge that innocent people are convicted, innocent people do go to jail, that the worst offenders aren't necessarily given the worst sentences or the most appropriate sentencing, it often does depend on the district attorney. And whether you get a capital charge depends on the district attorney, not necessarily the nature of the crime. It's a big part of our Bill of Rights, and it deserves our attention as a nation.
Certainly does. But there are others as well. Tell us another story.
Well, I'm thinking of a story that involves the First Amendment. It's much more contemporary. It's for those of you who are, I was going to say rock and roll fans because it's my generation, hip-hop fans, or in this case, a band called The Slants, which calls themselves synth pop. I guess I don't really know what that is, but it sounds good. Uh-huh. And certainly the creator of that band, a fellow named Simon Tam, is incredibly creative and very persistent. He's got that in common with other people who take their cases to the Supreme Court. They really have to be persistent. And in his case, it took 10 years for his case to wind up in the Supreme Court. It starts out, he's got this idea for a band. It's all Asian American. And in the way of reappropriating torments or derogatory language, he names his band The Slants.
But that's a term that I wasn't really even familiar with before I saw that. It's obviously a reference to the different shaped eyes that Asians have as opposed to Europeans. And it's apparently a pejorative term, and as you say, rather like the vagina monologues. And African Americans are reclaiming the N-word by using it. He was trying to do the same thing, but where did he run into problems with the government doing that?
He ran problems with the government because he needed to trademark the name of his band. As he says, you know, you can't have a commercial contract with a recording studio if you can't trademark your band name, if that can't be something you can enforce against others and have intellectual property in. So he starts with the Patent and Trademark Office and receives a notice that, no, this is a derogatory term for Asians and you can't use it. And he's kind of puzzled because he thinks, well, you know, there's nothing inherent to the word slant per se that in any context is going to be derogatory. For instance, you can have a slant 8 engine, or you can use the word slant in any number of ways that's not inherently pejorative in, say, that perhaps the N-word might be, or for those of us who used to root for the Washington football team, the R-word could be. And so he realizes, he says, wait a minute, you've approved all these trademarks with the word slant in it, and yet you're telling me as an Asian American that it's pejorative and I can't use it. So the only people who can't use the word slant are Asian Americans.
That's an interesting argument.
Yeah. On the other hand, for me, having had this was an interesting sidebar for me to write, because my closest friend in high school was born in Taiwan of mainland Chinese parents. They immigrated. Her mother's like a second mother to me, and I was very concerned about not wanting to appear disrespectful, because there's controversy within the Asian American community about it. Surprise, surprise. And so when I talked to them, and they kind of took a poll, it was like the young ones were, what's the big deal? We're proud of him. He won his case unanimously. The middle-aged people like me were kind of, I can see both sides. And the older people were like, no, we don't want to hear that, because their experience had been hearing it in so many painful circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But we all decided that it was important to include that story, because the principle is, as Simon will be the first to tell you, there are lots of things that we don't want everyday people doing, that everyday people can do, that we don't want the government to do. Essentially, we don't want the government to be able to decide, when is this a slur, when is it not, when do you have legal authority in what can be very contentious territory. And as the Supreme Court proved, a unanimous decision, the Supreme Court, on a contentious issue, as you know how rare that is.
Very rare indeed. And so ultimately, Tam won.
Yes, he did.
He got trademark protection for the slants, and I think
yes,
they still
did.
Exist as a band, don't they?
Indeed, they do. And Simon is a very fierce First Amendment advocate. He's won several awards, no surprise, and he was very gracious to let me include his New York Times op-ed in my book. And very wonderful young man. I'm very proud of his perseverance to establish that the government should not be deciding words we can and cannot use. Now, we people have our own ability to decide, well, you know what? I don't think I really like that. I'm not going to buy the album. Or I'm not going to get season tickets to the Washington football team. Well, even supposing I could. So that's still within our personal realm. But in terms of the government being able to prohibit certain types of speech, it's kind of a bedrock principle. And it applies in this case with trademarks.
Yeah, it certainly does. And I'm glad you brought up that distinction, because people will equate private revulsion at the use of some of these terms and consequences, private consequences, with government suppression. And it's not the same thing.
Right.
So as long as the government's not involved, then it's not a First Amendment issue, even though it may be a free speech issue in some sense. And I think the most salient example of that recently is the cancellation of the number one show at ABC, Roseanne. That wasn't the government doing that. That was ABC reacting to those horrible tweets that she had. I didn't know Ambien did that to people. at any rate, and so she suffered consequences, and you know, severe ones, and a lot of other people did too, unfortunately.
Well, and that's what I keep reminding people, and you know this as a law professor, probably the most misunderstood thing about the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights in general is it doesn't apply to your private employer. Unless your employer is the government, you don't have any free speech rights at work.
No, you
really don't.
No, you don't, and we don't like that idea. Mm-hmm. But just think about this. Could you go in and call your boss a nasty name?
Exactly.
Sure you can, and then he's going to fire you,
exactly.
Or she's going to fire you. And in much the same fashion, they can set workplace rules. In fact, unless you've got some kind of contract with your employer can fire you for pretty much any reason except for a few prohibited reasons like sexual discrimination. But, you know, with those few exceptions, basically everybody's at will if you don't have a contract.
Exactly.
And that's part of it. That's just at one aspect of it.
Hey, it's Stuart Harrison. It's your weekly Constitutional, and I'm talking to Linda Monk, who's written a really cool book called The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide. We've been hearing some really good stories from her, and soon we'll hear some more, so stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Linda Monk, the author of The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide. Linda's been telling us some great stories today, and that's really important because the only thing that brings the Bill of Rights to life is the people who actually, well, use it.
The one that's near and dear my heart, growing up as a young girl in segregated Mississippi and experiencing when my schools were desegregated finally in 1970, 16 years after the Supreme Court had said they should be, was to learn of the story of an African-American woman who was raised under limited circumstances. Her family had been sharecroppers. My grandparents were sharecroppers. And she, in the what's called the Freedom Summer of 1964, when SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, made Mississippi, which was regarded as the hardest nut to crack in the civil rights movement, that Mississippi was the most oppressive to rights for African Americans. You know, and this is 100 years after emancipation. This is almost 100 years after the 14th Amendment. We don't have the Voting Rights Act yet. And in Mississippi, we have this huge population of African Americans. At that time, I think it was more like 40% of the state. Today, it's a little over 35%. There was no voter registration. Surprise, surprise. I wonder why. Because of massive violence against people who did try to register. SNCC did an organizing community campaign, and they wanted to find people in the community. And Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer was one they found. She was an incredible woman with incredible voice. She could sing like the voice of God was shaking the rafters. When she sang This Little Light of Mine, you believe she had a huge life. And so she was one of the people that risked her life, and it was risking her life, to go down to the courthouse and register to vote at the age of 44. She wasn't allowed to register. She was asked a question about one of the 290 provisions in the Mississippi Constitution, and she was denied her voting rights. Now, my grandfather, whom I loved, who couldn't read or write, but he was white, was not asked to read and explain any provisions of the Mississippi Constitution. He could vote.
They asked her to explain ex post facto, didn't they?
Yeah.
And how many people, just off the top of their heads, could explain what an ex post facto law is?
Yeah, she said, I know about as much about that as a horse knows about Christmas Day. And this is part of what I love about her, is because she's not technically educated, she says it in a very direct, truthful way. It's the unvarnished voice of truth that you hear when she speaks. And she eventually goes to the 1964 Democratic Convention. She's sent there by the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. They had parallel elections because white people wouldn't allow them to vote in the Democratic primary. And she goes on national television and challenges the Democratic Party that their delegation be seated, the integrated delegation. And she says, is this America where our lives be threatened daily and we have to be threatened to vote in America? And LBJ, who's trying to craft the convention because he wants to be swept in and he believes he needs those white segregationist to elect him, goes on national television, interrupts her speech, but guess what? Everybody plays it all that night. She's one of those, when you talk about speaking truth to power, she's the classic example. And she's elected to Congress that fall on the Mississippi Freedom Party ballot. By the way, the all-white delegation walked out during the middle of the convention, and they didn't vote Democratic either. Mm-hmm. And then when she goes to Congress, they don't seat her in 1965, but she says, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And so when we talk about voting rights principles, or when we talk about the 14th Amendment and equal protection of the law, she was one of those warriors that brought those principles to reality.
Yeah, the 14th Amendment, as we both know, is not part of the first 10. It's 14. But as you point out in your book, you included it and the discussion of it for a couple of reasons. First of all, the 14th Amendment's due process clause was the vehicle through which these constitutional protections were extended to the states. That is, the states could not violate these rights any more than the national government could. And then the equal protection clause was the very first time that the word equal appeared in the Constitution.
Exactly.
Extremely important. It should have been part of the Bill of Rights. It just wasn't.
No, that slavery shouldn't have been part of the Constitution either, but it was.
Yeah, yeah.
So it takes something like the Civil War, where finally, out of that incredible conflict, where African Americans themselves, we talk about Lincoln freed the slaves. Well, no, not really. Lincoln made sure it got in the Constitution, but African Americans refused to be slaves anymore. When that conflict broke out, Lincoln had said, well, you know, if I can save the Union without freeing a single slave, I will do it. Now, that there's no question that Southern states seceded because of slavery, but it was not a foregone conclusion that emancipation of all slaves was going to come out of the Civil War.
You know, that's a fascinating tale. We've talked about Abraham Lincoln a number of times on this program, and that's the evolution of his thinking over the course
yes.
of the Civil War. I think he was always personally very anti-slavery, but he didn't feel that he had the constitutional power to end it where it existed.
Well, and except so, this is, and since we've gotten into this topic, I want to bring it out. Mm-hmm. He did. It's in his first inaugural address. He did support the Corwin Amendment, which would have made slavery permanently an unamendable part of the Constitution. Would have said that within each state, slavery could become permanent. And we refer to domestic institutions, but that's what they were talking about. So,
oh yeah, I know, but I think he was trying at that stage to avoid what happened.
Well, I'm not saying that. I mean, I know that's what his cause was, but it's kind of shocking for most people to think of Lincoln that way. Of yes, yep. not only would he have not made that a war goal, he was willing to make it permanently unamendable part of the Constitution.
Yeah, I think Lincoln was a Union man first and foremost.
Yeah.
I think he was also opposed to slavery, but that was secondary. First and foremost, he had to save the Union. And we've had some fascinating discussions on that topic. But Linda, I think we have time for maybe just one more story. So why don't you tell me about Michael Hardwick? You heard there, that's not a familiar name to a lot of people, but that's a particularly tragic tale.
It is, definitely. And I pay special attention to him in the book because today we're seeing that LGBTQ citizens are claiming their rights to equality under the 14th Amendment. And we've seen that expressed both in terms of tax law, but also in terms of legal marriage, that the Supreme Court has finally ruled that marriage is such a fundamental right that it cannot be denied to LGBTQ citizens without violating the 14th Amendment. And that's both on equal protection and due process grounds. But, you know, a victory often has many, many defeats before it. And the first substantial open defeat and challenge to laws that discriminated against gay people and other citizens was in Bowers v. Hardwick. And that involved a young man named Michael Hardwick. He lived in Georgia at the time. Very attractive, very vital, very active young man. And he was a bartender, and a police officer that he believed had been harassing him, in fact, got an expired warrant and tried to enforce it in Michael Hardwick's own bedroom, in which he was engaged with the act with a consenting adult male, and charged him under Georgia sodomy law. And people today might find it difficult to remember that there were those times, and that was the 1980s. That's mm-hmm. not that long ago, you know, that we've made such fundamental shifts that people were afraid to be arrested at gay bars because they could be their names would be in the paper, they would be discriminated in terms of employment, they would be harassed, and as Michael Hardwick was, beaten and almost killed. And yet he chose to be that voice, to courageously stand up against this unjust law, which, as he pointed out, didn't say on its face that it limited application to homosexuals. And in fact, it was called a sodomy law, which involved the orifice of one partner with the sexual organs of another. And as other people have pointed out, those are sexual practices that are enjoyed by many heterosexuals as well. And yet,
you're doing a very good job, Linda, of describing it without using offensive language. That's always a challenge. But I mean, the very concept of sodomy is something that I think younger people aren't even familiar with. And it's multiplied by the fact that even the sodomy statutes themselves are also not very specific. You know, in fact, some of the earliest ones, they would talk about the infamous act against nature, whatever that is.
Right. Right.
But this one was, and as you point out, some statutes are written specifically targeting typically gay men, not so much lesbians, but some of them were written simply prohibiting certain acts. And
this one in particular, you know,
I've often said, I've been making presentations, I've been teaching the Bowers case for 15, 20 years, and I would say, I'm not looking for a show of hands, but just think back on your own history.
Yeah.
And how many of you are felons,
mm-hmm.
whether you're gay or straight?
Of this law.
Yeah, and that's really what it comes down to. We are criminalizing private sexual conduct between consenting adults. Don't mix it up with children. Don't mix it up with prostitution. Just think about private consensual sex. We're not talking about pornography or any public display. Private consensual sex between consenting adults. And he took it all the way to the Supreme Court, and what happened?
He lost. And a big reason that he lost was because Justice Scalia was very clear that this is a law against homosexual conduct. And it was by no means, on its face, a law against homosexual conduct, because I'm sure even amongst probably Justice Scalia's own law clerks, there had been a few heterosexuals that had engaged in some of that behavior. And Justice Lewis Powell, who voted in the majority in that case, it was a 5-4 case, later said that that was one of the decisions that he regretted most. And because of that case, there was such a feeling of outrage, both amongst the LGBT community and amongst the straight community, but particularly amongst the LGBT community, because if there was going to be any case that was won, that's what Michael Hardwick said. He said, this was the perfect case. This was the case, he said, and I was the perfect defendant or plaintiff, because he wasn't married, he wasn't in a job where he would, well, he might be fired, but he could always get another one, he said. So this is him kind of saying, it was, if not me, who, if not now, when? And that was his moment. And he sacrificed a lot. He got run out of Atlanta, had to go live in Florida with his family. And then in the midst of all that, after the decision, discovered he was HIV positive, and that was before the multi-drug regimen. And his loving parents and sister, mother and sister take care of him. And he dies at 67 pounds.
How old was he?
I think he was in his late 30s, early 40s. I don't have terrible. That, but he was a young man. And struck down, having, you know, given his all for trying to protect freedom in America. And we need to point out that when the Bowers v. Hardwick decision came down, that the consistent application in terms of sexual privacy amongst consenting adults in the privacy of your own bedroom had been protected. So were it not for strong animus and hatred of homosexuals and homosexual activity, that should have been an open and shut case under every principle that had been established about sexual liberty, sexual privacy, consenting adults. And it's one of the great defeats in American history, and yet it becomes a rallying point that leads ultimately to greater freedom, because it's overturned in Lawrence v. Texas, I believe that's
2003.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and Scalia was in dissent in that one.
I'm sorry.
And Justice Scalia was in dissent in that one.
Right.
Brought up an interesting catalog of horribles, including, I think, bestiality was going to be next. But we can leave that subject for another day. I think we're about out of time. Your book is now available. It's available on Kindle. Is it also a print version?
Yeah.
Okay,
it's
so people can get this wherever friendly books local bookstore.
Online and wherever books are sold. And I hope that the point of including all these stories is to remind us that ultimately it still comes down to us, that ultimately it's not the Supreme Court, it's we the people who are the ultimate power. And when we disagree with the court, we have to keep trying, just like the people that followed Michael Hardwick, and you have to keep fighting for justice. And that's the ultimate test, is we the people.
Well, Linda Monk, thank you very, very much for your time. And the title of your book again is?
The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide.
And let's
with a foreword by the notorious RBG.
Indeed. Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote your foreword. I realize I keep trying to close here. How did you get her to do that?
I got her to do it by writing her a very nice letter, to which she gave a very nice reply. At the time, my book had won a big award by the American Bar Association. I think that helped. But I think what really helped was the fact that Justice Ginsburg is very devoted to the idea that the spirit of liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. That's my favorite quote from Judge Learned Hand, and turns out it's her favorite quote too.
During the Napoleonic Wars, Britain expanded its navy exponentially, causing an extreme shortage of sailors. To solve its manpower deficit, they began forcefully impressing American merchant sailors into the Royal Navy. After years of harassment on the high seas, President James Madison declared war against the British in 1812. In his second inaugural address, Madison explained why the United States had no other choice but to go to war. War was not declared on the part of the United States until it had long been made on them, until arguments and postulations had been exhausted, until a positive declaration had been received that the wrongs provoking it would not be discontinued, nor until this last appeal could no longer be delayed without breaking down the spirit of the nation, destroying all confidence in itself and in its political institutions, and either perpetuating a state of disgraceful suffering or regaining by more costly sacrifices and more severe struggles our lost rank and respect among independent powers. I'm Matt Dara, speaking to you from the Potter Studios at Montpelier with the Madison Minute.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Linda Monk, the author of The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide, and also to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who wrote the introduction to that book. Isn't that cool? Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Kel Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.